on VOA1.
Welcome to the Voice of America's Learning English, a 30-minute show designed for English learners. Today, we listen to another segment of a podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. And we close the show, as always, with an American story. But first, Ashley Thompson and I have this report. What do you think these names have in common? Royal, Charlie, Salem, Schuyler, Justice, Oakley. Well, in the United States, all of these names are considered fitting for girls and boys. They are considered gender neutral. And modern American parents appear more willing than ever to consider the possibility of gender fluidity in their children. Linda Murray is the head of BabyCenter.com. She told the AP, "This generation is truly interested in gender-neutral names." The Social Security Administration puts out a list of most popular baby names every year based on its registrations. Observers say the gender-neutral names have not made it into the top 10. However, they say such names are heavily represented in the longer list. Younger parents seem especially likely to choose gender-neutral names for their babies. Pop culture and honoring family or religious history are important to baby naming. But more and more parents are choosing names that can be used for either sex.
Lori Kinkler, a psychologist in San Antonio, Texas, said she chose the gender-neutral name Riley for her daughter. She said if the 3-year-old does not identify as female later in life, she will not have to change her name. In Kinkler's words, "I like that she feels she has options and knows she'll be accepted by us no matter what." Pamela Redman Satran is a writer of The Baby Name Bible and Cool Names for Babies. She also writes about the subject online and is a founder of the baby name site Nameberry.com. Satran says possible gender fluidity is not the only reason parents choose unisex names. She says a lot of people choose unisex names because they think they're cool or they're meaningful to themselves, but they raise their kids in a very gender-specific way. Kirsten Hammond, 45, lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. She and her husband named their daughters Tegan and Sigrid. She considers both names gender neutral. She said, "Sigrid is technically a girl's name, but because it's so uncommon in the U.S., it reads as gender neutral to most people." She said she and her husband did not directly discuss gender neutrality, but she said she did think about the difficulties women face in the world. In her words, "Whether we like it or not, names that skew a little masculine or less feminine are perceived as stronger, and I wanted that for my girls."
Pamela Satran said some gender-neutral names are part of other trends, such as choosing traditionally last names as first names, like Madison. She also noted gender-neutral names linked to geography and nature are another trend. Examples include river, lake, Dakota, and blue. Some countries bar unisex names by law, including Portugal, Denmark, and Iceland. In Germany, local registrars decide if an unusual name would harm a child. It is hard to say how such laws might affect Harper. It was the 10th most popular name for baby girls in the Social Security Administration's 2016 list. For boys, it was number 793. The top female name was Emma, followed by Olivia, Ava, Sophia, Isabella, Mia, Charlotte, Abigail, and Emily. For boys, Noah was the top name, with Liam, William, Mason, James, Benjamin, Jacob, Michael, Elijah, and Ethan, rounding out the top 10. NameBerry.com examined the 2016 Social Security Administration data and created a top 50 gender-neutral name list. The most popular are Charlie, Finley, Skyler, Justice, and Royal. Rounding out the top 10 were Lennon, Oakley, Armani, Azariah, and Landry. Rebecca Connolly is a 29-year-old mother in the western New York town of Castile. She said she and her guitar-playing husband chose Lennon Wallace for their son, now 2 years old. Both she and her husband are fans of the Beatles' John Lennon for his music and his activism. Connolly said, "As a child, I felt bad for all the Taylor, Jordan, and Jamies I knew, whose names didn't identify their sex. By the time I was having kids, 50% of the little girls I met were named Riley, Avery, Logan, etc. And I realized all soft-sounding boy names are now considered unisex." Connolly also has a daughter, Lucille Beatrice, and is pregnant with a second son. She said their current leading choice for the baby's name is considered masculine. She would not tell what it is. But she said, with the rising popularity of boy names for girls, it might be considered unisex by the time he goes to school. That is fine with her. "I plan to teach them there is nothing inferior about women, so sharing a name with them is not a big deal," Connolly said. "Being called a girl is not an insult." Next up, we listen to part of another What It Takes podcast. Here is host Alice Winkler.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg has led an illustrious life, and she's an inspiration to lots of people, women in particular. Some are even a little obsessed with her, wearing T-shirts with her picture, affectionately referring to her as Notorious RBG. So who did she look up to growing up? Well, that's where Nina Totenberg began her conversation for the Academy of Achievement. The NPR senior legal correspondent sat down with the Associate Justice, at the Supreme Court on July 13, 2016, for a long, intimate discussion about the law and life.
Tell me about your mother, because after a long illness, she died the day before you were to graduate from high school. And I know that she was the model for your life in some ways.
My mother was a voracious reader, and one gift that she gave me was loving to read. My favorite memory was sitting on her lap, and she would read books to me. We had a weekly excursion to the public library, and she would leave me in the library in the children's section, have her hair done, and then pick me up, and I had my 3 or 4 books for the week.
Those books often included Greek and Norse mythology, and of course, Nancy Drew, that exemplar of young female independence. The library, by the way, was in Flatbush, the section of Brooklyn where Ruth Bader grew up, and it was on the second floor over a Chinese restaurant. So Ginsburg says the smell of Chinese food has always brought up pleasant associations for her of those trips to the library with her mother.
You spoke about her on the day that you were nominated to the court in the Rose Garden. What do you think she'd make of you today?
I think she would be surprised and no end pleased. My mother was born in an era when it was a disgrace for a married woman to work if her husband could support her. And so my mother, who started working when she was 15, she graduated high school at 15, went immediately to work so she could help the family while the eldest son went off to Cornell. He was the only one in the family that had a college education. So then she did not work once she married. I think she wished that she had been able to continue. Her big message to me was, whatever you do, be independent. Even if you meet Prince Charming, be able to fend for yourself.
She actually did meet Prince Charming not long after she left for college at Cornell, and we'll get to that in a moment. But first, to her academics. At Cornell, Ruth Bader had some wonderful professors. One, a particularly famous novelist who influenced her writing for the rest of her life, Vladimir Nabokov.
Author of Lolita and many other things. He was a man who was in love with the sound of words, and he would read aloud from the books that were assigned and showed us how a writer could paint pictures with words and how important having the right word in the right place would be. He gave an example of why he liked writing in the English language. I'm not sure that his first language was Russian. It may have been French. But the example that he gave was, if you're speaking French and you want to refer to a white horse, so you say, le cheval blanc. First you see the horse, and horse stimulates brown in your mind. Then you have to readjust it with white. But in English, white comes before horse, so you see the white horse immediately. And that was the kind of thing that was important to Nabokov. He was a marvelous teacher, wonderfully amusing.
But here's a curious thing Nina Totenberg noted during her interview. At Cornell, Ruth would often study in the bathrooms.
Why did you do that?
Cornell in the early 50s was considered a great school for girls because there were 4 men to every woman. It was a strict quota system, and that meant the women were ever so much smarter than the boys. But it wasn't the thing to do to show how smart you were. It was much better that you gave the impression that you weren't working at all, that you were a party girl. So I did my studying in various bathrooms on the campus. Then when I went back to the dormitory, I didn't have homework to do.
So you didn't look like a grunt.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, so, and it's at Cornell that you meet Marty Ginsburg, and at first you were just friends, but you realized pretty soon that he was different than the other boys because?
Yes, I many times said that Marty Ginsburg was the first boy I met who cared that I had a brain.
Marty was a year ahead of her in school, so once she'd graduated from Cornell, at the top of her class, mind you, they got married. Marty's mother became like a second mother to her, one who dispensed sage advice.
We were married in Marty's home, and his mother took me into the bedroom, her bedroom, and said, "Dear, I'd like to tell you the secret of a happy marriage." "Yes, what is the secret?" "It helps sometimes to be a little deaf."
You can find the whole podcast on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Now it's time for an American story. Today we hear a tall tale. Tall tales are humorous stories passed down through the generations by storytellers. Faith Lapidus explains further.
Long ago, the people who settled in undeveloped areas in America first told tall tales. After a hard day's work, people gathered to tell each other funny stories. Each group of workers had its own tall tale hero. Paul Bunyan was a hero of North America's lumberjacks, the workers who cut down trees. He was known for his strength, speed, and skill. Tradition says he cleared forests from the northeastern United States to the Pacific Ocean. Some people say Paul Bunyan was the creation of storytellers from the middle western Great Lakes area of the United States. Other people say the stories about him came from French Canada. Early in the 20th century, a writer prepared a collection of Paul Bunyan stories. They were included in a publication from the Red River Lumber Company in Minnesota. It is not known if the stories helped the company's sales, but they became extremely popular. Here is Shep O'Neill with our story about Paul Bunyan.
Many years ago, Paul Bunyan was born in the northeastern American state of Maine. His mother and father were shocked when they first saw the boy. Paul was so large at birth that five large birds had to carry him to his parents. When the boy was only a few weeks old, he weighed more than 45 kilograms. As a child, Paul was always hungry. His parents needed 10 cows to supply milk for his meals. Before long, he ate 50 eggs and 10 containers of potatoes every day. Young Paul grew so big that his parents did not know what to do with him. Once, Paul rolled over so much in his sleep that he caused an earthquake. This angered people in the town where his parents lived, so the government told his mother and father they would have to move him somewhere else. Paul's father built a wooden cradle, a traditional bed for a baby. His parents put the cradle in waters along the coast of Maine. However, every time Paul rolled over, huge waves covered all the coastal towns. So his parents brought their son back on land. They took him into the woods. This is where he grew up. As a boy, Paul helped his father cut down trees. Paul had the strength of many men. He also was extremely fast. He could turn off a light and then jump into his bed before the room got dark. Maine is very cold for much of the year. One day, it started to snow. The snow covered Paul's home and a nearby forest. However, this snow was very unusual. It was blue. The blue snow kept falling until the forest was covered. Paul put on his snowshoes and went out to see the unusual sight. As he walked, Paul discovered an animal stuck in the snow. It was a baby ox. Paul decided to take the ox home with him. He put the animal near the fireplace. After the ox got warmer, his hair remained blue. Paul decided to keep the blue ox and named him Babe. Babe grew very quickly. One night, Paul left him in a small building with the other animals. The next morning, the barn was gone, and so was Babe. Paul searched everywhere for the animal. He found Babe calmly eating grass in a valley, with the barn still on top of his back. Babe followed Paul and grew larger every day. Every time Paul looked, Babe seemed to grow taller. In those days, much of North America was filled with thick green forests. Paul Bunyan could clear large wooded areas with a single stroke of his large, sharp axe. Paul taught Babe to help with his work. Babe was very useful. For example, Paul had trouble removing trees along a road that was not straight. He decided to tie one end of the road to what remained of a tree in the ground. Paul tied the other end to Babe. Babe dug his feet in the ground and pulled with all his strength until the road became straight. In time, Paul and Babe the Blue Ox left Maine and moved west to look for work in other forests. Along the way, Paul dug out the Great Lakes to provide drinking water for Babe. They settled in a camp near the Onion River in the state of Minnesota. Paul's camp was the largest in the country. The camp was so large that a man had to have 1 week's supply of food when walking from one side of the camp to the other. Paul decided to get other lumberjacks to help with the work. His work crew became known as the Seven Axe Men. Each man was more than 2 meters tall and weighed more than 160 kilograms. All of the axe men were named Elmer. That way, they all came running whenever Paul called them. The man who cooked for the group was named Sourdough Sam. He made everything, except coffee, from sourdough, a substance used in making sourdough bread. Every Sunday, Paul and his crew ate hotcakes. Each hotcake was so large that it took 5 men to eat one. Paul usually had 10 or more hotcakes, depending on how hungry he was. The table where the men ate was so long that a server usually drove to one end of the table and stayed the night. The server drove back in the morning with a fresh load of food. Paul needed someone to help with the camp's finances. He gave the job to a man named Johnny Inkslinger. Johnny kept records of everything, including wages and the cost of feeding Babe. He sometimes used 9 containers of writing fluid a day to keep such detailed records. The camp also was home to Sport, the reversible dog. One of the workers accidentally cut Sport in two. The man hurried to put the dog back together, but made a mistake. He bent the animal's back the wrong way. However, that was not a problem for Sport. He learned to run on his front legs until he was tired. Then he turned the other way and ran on his back legs. Big mosquitoes were a problem at the camp. The men attacked the insects with their axes and long sticks. Before long, the men put barriers around their living space. Then Paul ordered them to get big bees to destroy the mosquitoes. But the bees married the mosquitoes, and the problem got worse. They began to produce young insects. One day, the insects' love of sweets caused them to attack a ship that was bringing sugar to the camp. At last, the mosquitoes and bees were defeated. They ate so much sugar, they could not move. Paul always gave Babe the Blue Ox a 35-kilogram piece of sugar when he was good, but sometimes Babe liked to play tricks. At night, Babe would make noises and hit the ground with his feet. The men at the camp would run out of the buildings where they slept, thinking it was an earthquake. When winter came, Babe had trouble finding enough food to eat. Snow covered everything. Ole, the blacksmith, solved the problem. He made huge green sunglasses for Babe. When Babe wore the sunglasses, he thought the snow was grass. Before long, Babe was strong and healthy again. One year, Paul's camp was especially cold. It was so cold that the men let their facial hair grow very long. When the men spoke, their words froze in the air. Everything they said remained frozen all winter long and did not melt until spring. Paul Bunyan and Babe left their mark on many areas. Some people say they were responsible for creating Puget Sound in the western state of Washington. Others say Paul Bunyan and Babe cleared the trees from the states of North Dakota and South Dakota. They prepared this area for farming. Babe the Blue Ox died in South Dakota. One story says he ate too many hotcakes. Paul buried his old friend there. Today, the burial place is known as the Black Hills. Whatever happened to Paul Bunyan? There are lots of stories. Some people say he was last seen in Alaska, or even the Arctic Circle. Another tradition says he still returns to Minnesota every summer. It says Paul moves in and out of the woods, so few people ever know that he is there.
We have come to the end of today's show. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver.